I'm Daphne Wollstonecraft, and you're listening to Night Watch, a show of terrifyingly true stories. If you'd like your story told on the show, email it to watcher at nightwatchpod.com. Every year, hundreds of people are killed by trains. Statistically, every 2 hours or so, someone is killed in some train-related accident, whether it be an employee, more rare, a passenger, or someone crossing the tracks at the wrong time. Or, if they're doing it intentionally, at the right time. Dogs, cats, pets, people, you name it, we see it. Young folks like to play this stupid game called chicken, where they dare each other to cross the tracks as a train is fast approaching, like a game of dare. Many people have died this way. It's not only traumatic for the families of the victims and the friend who witnesses the horrors, but also the train engineers and conductors who have to watch their dead bodies explode into view after being demolished by a moving vehicle that weighs thousands of tons. The first note I'll make is to never, ever be that person. No living being is stronger or faster than a train. This isn't the movies. We won't stop in time to save your life. As an engineer myself, I was lucky enough to work for nearly 20 years without incident. The worst thing I'd seen on the tracks was a dead horse whose body was lying nearby, mangled. It accidentally trotted in front of the tracks, probably not seeing the train or not knowing how fast or how strong it was. Going at the pace we are, the horse came and went from my vision faster than my mind could push it out of view. But that was it. That was the worst I'd seen. Until a few years ago. My conductor Tim and I were making our way through the trees going southbound in the northeast with freight. We had done this many times before, looking ahead and shooting the shit. This was one of our favorite routes because the trees surrounding either side of the track were thick and scenic. We're keeping our eyes ahead, communicating with other trains, and just enjoying the view on that peaceful, late, glum afternoon. As an engineer, one of my main duties, other than driving and operating the train, is to keep the freight safe. Looking ahead is important to notice any oncoming issues because if you have to pull the emergency brake for something, it's going to take the train at least a mile to come to a stop, just based on the sheer weight and speed of the train. Like I said before, if you're fooling around on the tracks and it's not noticed in time, you're screwed, and so are the rest of us. As I was saying, Tim and I were looking ahead, going 50 miles an hour with the headlights on as the sun was beginning its descent. It all happened so fast, but we know what we both saw. On our right, the headlights blasted against a white figure, moving with great speed out of the woods on all fours. This wasn't an animal. It was a person. Naked and running on all fours until it reached the track. Knowing we couldn't stop in time, we thrust the emergency brake into play anyway because for the first time in my career, a train I was operating came in direct contact with a human body. What I will never forget is the person's face. After running out of the woods at an impossible speed in the position he was in, he ran right on the tracks like he meant to do it. But while he was about to make contact with the train, he looked up into our front window with the most evil smile I have ever seen. And a split second later, his body flew up, painting the scene red. Here's where things get downright unbelievable, though. Tim and I yelled in fear, unable to mask the horrors that we had just witnessed. About a mile and a half up the track, the train finally came to a stop, and we recorded the time, as is protocol, and called the train dispatcher to report what had happened. We relayed the details and explained to each other our certainty that this person had jumped in front of the tracks on purpose. And this was really not us trying to divert blame. This is really what we saw. As I said, this was my first real incident, but Tim had been in the business a little longer than I had, and he had seen something like this one other time years earlier, when someone took their life in front of his train. They had even left a note at home, so the investigation closed, stating suicide. But in our shared incident, we couldn't wrap our heads around what we had seen before the person made contact with our freight. How had they been running on all fours? Why were they naked? Where did they come from? Not only were we in a remote and dense portion of the forest, miles away from any main roads, but the way this person moved, it was inhuman. We sat there, completely shaken up, waiting for emergency responders to arrive and assess the scene, just backtracking and reliving the details. We didn't know how we were going to explain what we saw, but we were confident that we at least both had the exact same story. This incident messed me up, but not enough to make up what we saw. It was so clear in our minds. Those movements, that face, that smile. Around 15 minutes later, responders arrived to the scene, and Tim and I hopped out of the train to retell our story while the scene was assessed. We knew the person's corpse would be about a mile and a half back, as we recorded where the incident occurred. So we sent responders back a ways to check it out and see what was left of the person. Minutes later, with Tim and I sitting on the sidelines, shaken beyond belief, one of the emergency responders came back laughing. Tim and I immediately scowled, wondering what on God's green earth was so funny about the death of a living being. It being the end of April, the guy asked if we were playing an April Fool's prank on him. But his laughter quickly turned to anger and annoyance. He told us off, saying that calling emergency responders and stopping a train on the basis of a fictitious incident was not only disrespectful, but illegal. Tim and I looked at each other astonished. We had no clue why this guy was saying all this. I'm sure we said something like, "What the hell are you talking about?" restating our story over and over again. That we saw a person run in front of the tracks. We saw their body fly into the air. We saw the blood. The responder pointed to the front of the train and asked, "What blood?" followed by, "What person?" pointing back at the rest of his team coming up behind him, holding a piece of a mannequin. The front of the train didn't have any blood on it, which would certainly not be the case if it made impact with a person, considering the damage of the impact. The other responders walked up holding various pieces of a mannequin destroyed on impact. They were all baffled that we could possibly think this mannequin was a real human being. Again, over and over, we explained that what we saw was not a mannequin. The person wasn't lying on the tracks. There weren't people nearby holding something and throwing it. We saw this person moving on their own. There was no one else in sight. There is no chance in hell. What we saw was simply a mannequin. In that moment, I thought back to all the true crime shows my wife loved to watch. How many people who witnessed a real body say that they resemble a mannequin because they're so still? But that wasn't the case here. If I had seen a person laying on the tracks completely still, I'd believe it, but it's not even close to how it played out. We stated our knowledge, not even belief, that there had to be remnants of a body out there, that there had to be a real person, that this mannequin they were holding had to be from some other train incident, some other time. That we were telling the truth. But they didn't believe us. Tim and I went back and walked a mile and a half up ourselves to see it. But they were right about one thing. There was no body. We both got the most unnerving feeling standing in the area we knew it happened. Looking into the woods and around the tracks for a corpse as night took over the sky was by far the scariest thing I have ever done. But there was no one and nothing out there. No blood, no fragments of a body, no one. To this day, we have no idea what went down. We talk about it once in a while, still both knowing what we saw, but not understanding what really happened. I know all of us true crime buffs have heard that time and time again, that it wasn't a mannequin, but I've never heard it the other way around. This next one is for all the parents out there with little kids who play with really creepy toys. One weekend morning, far too early, before the sun greeted us for the day, my 6-year-old daughter came into me in my husband's room, terrified. She was crying, saying that she was scared of something in her closet. Now, this might be a kid's worst nightmare, but it's also a parent's worst nightmare. Kids' minds go to monsters, parents' minds go to intruders. So I'm thinking, is there a person, some predator, in my daughter's closet right now? But it must have just been the sleepiness still lingering, because when I sat up, I knew that couldn't be true. It was 5 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, and my daughter was scared of everything. I thought a jacket maybe had fallen off the rack. Something explainable. Feeling assured that there wasn't a living being in my kid's room, I whispered to her as not to wake Daddy. He had a long night at work and always slept in late on the weekends. I asked her, "What did you see?" Wiping her tears. She said, "I heard someone say peekaboo." I wanted to batter her with questions. Who said peekaboo? Was it a lady's voice or a man's voice? How many times did they say it? Was it loud or was it quiet? I almost lost it. But I didn't have time for any of that. I told her to sit in my bed and stay put, not to move until mommy came back. I was slow at first, creeping into her room down the hall, trying to hear what she would have heard. But there was just silence. When I approached her room and got to the closet door, that's when I heard it too. Laughter, accompanied by those same words, peekaboo. But even worse, after the words peekaboo were the words, "I see you." But there was something very familiar about this voice, one I had known my whole life practically. It was Mickey Mouse. Strange, I thought. My daughter didn't have any Mickey Mouse anything in the house, but it sounded like a scruffy recording, not like a real person. With the lights on now, I pulled the door open, and in the middle of her closet, sitting on the floor, facing outwards, is a Mickey Mouse toy. One I had never seen before. Wearing a little blue onesie, with its hands up on either side of its eyes, like he's playing a game of peekaboo. Right when I saw him, he said those words again.
Peekaboo, I see you.
Where did this toy come from? Its onesie was a bit dirty, and it looked like a toy for a newborn baby, whereas my daughter was 6 years old. This isn't a toy she would have played with in the last 5 years. In the years since she had been an infant, we had moved house, so how this got into her closet, or into our house for that matter, is still a mystery to me. But I'm not just wondering that, I'm wondering, how is it in her closet, sitting in the middle of the room, like a person waiting to be played with, going off, speaking on its own? I checked her room for any actual intruders, but came up empty. No one to explain this strange toy. When I went back to my room with it, I put on a smile and acted like nothing was wrong, saying that it was just a toy and not to be worried. There was nothing to be afraid of, even though I felt extremely afraid in this moment. But her response was, "That's not my toy." I have no other children, and again, to this day, do not know where this thing came from. But I ran it down to the trash bin that morning and never saw it again. At least it didn't make its way back into the house, right? But for this next story, we are going back into the house, but this time, the attic. Most houses have an attic. Mine was something I never used personally, only my husband once in a while. I don't have a usable garage for storage, and luckily didn't have much for storage anyway, sans some Halloween and Christmas decorations, and some of my ex-husband's camping equipment. Since we don't have kids, we didn't have boxes of baby clothes or old homework and yearbooks like my mom has in her house. So to me, the attic was just a square in the ceiling that I didn't know or care how to access. And it's funny because I really never noticed it anyway. I mean, how often do you walk down your hallway or through your house looking up? Almost never. Once my ex-husband moved out, he kindly brought my decorations down and put them in our guest room's closet so I wouldn't have to go about getting them down from the attic. It was a kind gesture. Months go by, I've been living on my own, trying my best to push through and come out on the other side of my divorce. I'm in the hallway leading to my bedroom, guest room, and guest hall bathroom. I open the door to my shallow hall closet, and I'm putting some blankets away. I'd gotten more blankets after my divorce. Was that my subconscious needing comfort? And my closet was overstuffed. That's the closet I keep medicine, towels, extra cleaning supplies, etc. in, including blankets. Anyway, I'm shoving the blankets up on the top shelf, my neck craned all the way back, when I see something dark in the corner of my eye. Stopping mid-push, I whip my head around and look up at the hallway ceiling. There is a small black spot on the attic door. It's a small opening of what I learned later is called an access door, where it looked like the door hadn't quite been secured in place, leaving a little gap. I never look at this damn attic door, so I'm assuming my ex-husband didn't secure it when he was taking stuff out months earlier. The only concern I have at this point is that bugs or something would crawl out. So I grab the stepladder from the hall closet I was just shoving blankets into, climb on, and use the pads of my finger to shimmy it into place. When it clicked into place, I was happy, thinking I don't need my ex-husband to do this kind of stuff for me. I can get things done on my own. I carried on with my business after this, and I didn't think about it again. Well, until about 2 weeks later. There was a bulb broken on my string lights on my back patio. So I go inside my house to get my trusty stepladder to accomplish yet another small task that my ex-husband would have handled when I can't find the thing. The stepladder is gone. It's not in my hall closet where I had certainly returned it. It's not in any of the rooms. It's not outside. I am racking my brain to try to figure out if I used it since the attic situation, and I hadn't. I felt like I was going crazy, but I know I had to have put it somewhere, and I just couldn't remember. So the light went unfixed, and I continued to look all day, but I couldn't find it anywhere. That same night, I was tossing and turning in my bed, couldn't sleep. I sleep with the TV on and a fan on, but still, I heard a noise. My mind is running, but I settle on the fact that surely it's an animal outside or just the creaking of my house. My mom always said, if you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. Don't let your mind go to the worst-case scenario all the time. But unfortunately, on rare occasion, it's a zebra. I had to go to the restroom anyway, and I don't have one attached to my bedroom, so I come out of my room, turn on the light, and straight away, my eyes move up to the ceiling due to seeing darkness again. But this time, it wasn't just a small hole. The attic's access door was just gone. There I am, standing in the hallway, looking up at a large black rectangle in my ceiling. There's nothing on the floor or anywhere. In general, the door is taken off by pushing it in, so I didn't see a scenario where it could have fallen out, and if it did, it would be on the floor. But it wasn't. So I run inside my bedroom quietly, lock the door, and call my brother, who lives just two streets down from me in the same neighborhood. He answers on the second ring, and I whisper to him what's going on, saying, "I think there's someone in my house." He arrives at my house almost right away. He almost scared me when he pulled up. That's how sudden it was. My brother is a tall, strong guy, so while I'm still locked in my bedroom, he's flipping all the light switches on and walking room to room, looking in closets, under the bed, or so he told me, trying to see what could have happened. The strange thing is that we checked all the doors, and every single one of them was locked. When he arrived, he used his spare key to get inside and noted that the front door was locked. So that meant that if someone had been in my house, they were either still in there or they used my side mudroom door and turned the lock before leaving. But it was impossible to tell. I know what you guys are thinking, but did he check the attic? Of course he did, but there was absolutely nothing up there. It was completely empty. And this is an important thing to note, that the attic had nothing in it. Because 2 days later, that wasn't the case. My brother stayed in my house until I felt comfortable for him to leave, which was around an hour later. I was still scared, but without any proof of someone being in the house, I figured it was a faulty thing. I know. But what was I supposed to do? My brother secured the attic door, which was sitting out of its frame inside the attic, right next to the opening, and then went on his way. I stayed in my locked room all night and hardly got any sleep. I was just so scared. I tried to forget about it and move on, but two nights later, it happened again. I'm trying to sleep and can't, and this time I needed some water. I was officially spooked at the thought of leaving my room in the night again, but I forgot my Stanley cup in the living room, which I always keep with me at all times, including on my bedside. I let out a big sigh, come out of my bedroom, and go flying onto the floor. I had crashed into something tall and hard, with it falling next to me in a loud bang. The only light was coming from my bedroom, but I could see that what I encountered was the stepladder. Even though my knee was killing me after slamming it on the floor, I jump up and turn on the light. As I do, I hear the sound of running. I look towards the front door and see it swing open before a dark silhouette goes sprinting out and down the street. My whole body is quivering as I run back to my bedroom, slam the door, and call my brother again, who answers quickly and comes right over. When he got there, he too noticed the front door wide open. The stepladder that I had misplaced days earlier was laying on its side in the hallway, and the attic door was creating a black rectangle in the ceiling once again. This time, we put the pieces together that someone must have been using the stepladder to access my attic and sleep or stay up there, possibly pulling the ladder up with them while they were inside. When my brother looked up there this time, he found two things. One, a water bottle from a case in my kitchen, and two, one of my bras. It's hard for me to think about to this day not knowing who this person was or how long they had been there. I learned after this that there's a term called frogging where someone secretly lives in your house, and it seems like that was the case here. But how did they get in and out so seamlessly, and why was one of the only things up there not a pillow, not a blanket, not food, but one of my bras? At what point did they come into my room and take that? I don't think I'll ever stop wondering. Like we all needed another reason to be afraid of the attic. Our final story today is about a whistler. When I was 16 years old, I was on the dance team at my high school. That meant I had to be at various sports games to perform a practice dance along with my team, which was always fun and made me feel a part of the school while remaining active and spending more time with my friends. In order to spend even more time with my friends, I usually stayed after the games to watch the rest with them, drinking under the bleachers from a flask or planning after-game festivities for the weekend. In high school, going to football games was our ultimate night out time. Other than this, all we had to do was go to the movies or the frozen yogurt place downtown or to each other's houses. Football games gave us a chance to be out and be all together with other teens our age from other schools. We absolutely loved it, especially crossing to the other side to see if the other school's team had cute boys at their school. I lived really close to my school, which was great because I could always walk to and from class or practice or home games or whatever. I'd lived in the neighborhood for years, so I always felt comfortable walking home, even at night. Well, one Friday night, there was a football game. I danced with my team out on the field at halftime, had a blast, and unfortunately, had to get home sooner than usual. My little stepbrother was about 7 years old at this time, and my parents had an event for my dad's work, so I needed to speed home and watch my brother for the night. So I left before most anybody else did, which meant the road was pretty much empty, because people were either inside school property at the game, or they were home, or whatever, not in the vicinity of the school on a Friday night. I was wearing my dance uniform, so it was clear to anybody who saw me that I was young and came from school, and I was walking alone down the sidewalk. Because of how my neighborhood was made up, there's this stretch of road that didn't have streetlights because it was adjacent to a small patch of woods. Not like the woods, just a patch of trees with a little dirt road that was the quick way to get to my house. I think it was a bike path. I'm walking through this area when out of nowhere, I heard a branch crack behind me. Typical sounds from trees, yeah, but I turned around to see a person at the front of that path that I had been walking on. I was almost at the end of it, so I didn't know where this guy came from or how long he'd been behind me. But for the time being, he was just a shadowy figure. So not at all what a teenage girl wants to see when she's walking alone at night, but I didn't know what to do. I thought about running, but that idea scared me more. I hoped he was just a fellow student who was also making his way home and kept my pace. I kept walking, a bit faster now, and before I could make it to the end of that path, the person started whistling. It wasn't a dreadful tune, it was actually Camp Town Races, but that almost made it worse. It was supposed to be a happy song in a very dark, almost unhappy environment. like he was trying to act more casual by whistling. The only thing I liked about the whistling was that it gave me the opportunity to determine how far away he was at all times. It gave away his position on the path. But at the time, it made the situation that much creepier. I instantly felt like this guy was up to no good. I really wanted to know if it was a student, so I turned around and started walking backwards for a moment, facing him. When I did, the person stopped walking, stopped whistling, just stood there, aware of my movements. So I turned back around and started walking faster, almost jogging. And I think the person picked up on this because their pace seemed to quicken as well. I made it out of that little path and onto the sidewalk. Just up ahead was my house, but I was afraid to go into it because I started to think that the guy behind me wasn't a good guy or just a student. If he knew where I lived, I'd be there alone all night that night, watching my little brother. I didn't want to put either of us in danger. Luckily, my car was out on the street because I ran to it, fishing my keys out of my backpack as I did. When I turned my head as I ran, the guy was running too. And then, in the light of the lamps on the street, I could see his face. He looked to be in his 40s or 50s, so definitely not a student nor someone I recognized. Yet this guy was running after me. Fully panicking, I unlocked my door, jumped in, and locked the doors right away, turning on my car and getting ready to drive somewhere safe to call my parents. But before I could get my hand on the gear shift, he got to my car and started pulling on the handle, banging on the window. He was mad. There wasn't a car in front of me, so I pulled forward and sped off. And when I did, I could see him fuming in the rear view, throwing his hands in the air in anger. I drove up the street, past my school, and drove into a shopping plaza nearby before stopping and calling my dad. I wanted to get far enough away and in an area with other people in case that guy found me. I told my dad what was going on, and he went outside to check it out, but didn't see anyone. When I finally went home 15 minutes later, my parents canceled their plans to go to the party, worried that someone dangerous was out on the street. I parked my car in the garage for a few days after that and never walked home alone at night again. In today's episode, you heard It Wasn't a Mannequin by Nathan, Peekaboo by Monica, Who Was in My Attic by Andrea, and My Follower the Whistler by Hannah. Each story on Nightwatch is told with the permission of the experiencer. If you have a story for the show, send it to watcher@nightwatchpod.com. Nightwatch is a Dark West Productions podcast hosted and produced by me, Daphne Wollstonecroft. Also produced by Heath Merriman. Original score by Daniel Amon. Follow us on social media at Nightwatch Stories, and tune in every Thursday for a new episode.